This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Tom K. Wilson. Tom is a five-decade real estate investor who transitioned from a 30-year engineering career, managing some of Silicon Valley's pioneering high-tech companies, to a full-time investor in 2000. Since then, he has bought and sold over 4,000 units and over $400 million of real estate in eight states, including nine apartment buildings, 11 commercial properties, three condo conversion projects, 15 syndications, and has flipped over 650 houses. One of his companies, Wilson Investment Properties, provides high-quality commercial syndications to other investors. Tom and his wife of 50 years have lived in Silicon Valley for 49 years, where they are active in their community church and charitable organizations. Tom is a frequent speaker at investment clubs and expos, has a weekly radio show on real estate investing, and often provides investment education to other investors. Tom, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Bruce. I get tired whenever I hear that. It's like, how in the world did all that happen? I don't know. I was having too much fun, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've tried to keep up with you walking. So what's your secret with that? What do you do every morning?
Well, you know, I've always felt that you want to keep all of the body active as well as the mind. So I'm fortunate to arrived at Silicon Valley and or what was to become Silicon Valley in 69 and always aspired to living in the hills. So I was able to ride the economic wave and fortunate enough to live up in the hills here on the edge of Silicon Valley. So it's pretty steep here. So I got a Swiss friend and a Czech friend and my Labrador retriever, and we go hike 3 miles and climb 1,000 feet every morning. So that helps keep my blood going.
I guess so. And what's interesting about the people I hang with and people you hang with, you know, I just turned 65 this year, and you're not allowed to use age as an excuse where I work out.
No. Absolutely not. You know, I climbed Mount Whitney last year. I didn't see anybody on the hill my age, which was at the time 70.
Yeah.
It's like, well, whatever. I don't know. Some of my friends say that I must be an alien from another planet. I don't know what it is. I don't know to what degree we can kind of create our own vitality and to what degree we've, you know, fortunate to born with the genes that give us the health and ability to do that. But I've always had high energy and always loved getting things done. And, you know, to me, retirement is being able to do what you want to do. And and for the most part, I'm doing what I want to do.
That's a good thing. An engineering background and real estate investing. I don't often see those two going together.
You know, most of our clients for Wilson Investment Properties during their period of years when we were providing rental houses and now with multifamily commercial syndications, actually, I'd say 80% of our clients are all techies and engineers. And I think as you probably know from SJRII up here, where you've been a frequent speaker, it's a very analytical crowd. And I think analytical people make good investors because they don't let emotion get in the way, right? So it's a numbers business. And I think that's why it works. Now, you know, how did I get into real estate? Well, I never planned to. I thought I was going to be designing widgets all my life and manufacturing them and running lines. And but when I landed here, my first company, Fairchild, found me a rental home. I showed up. The landlord lived next door, and I learned that he owned half the street. He didn't even have a college education. And so that was a real aha moment, a real real crossroads for me. So those seeds got planted then, and I realized that maybe just working hard wasn't enough. You had to do some smart investing as well. So fortunately, we in 1970 had our first opportunity to buy our first house, and my wife's hand was shaking as we signed that contract for $30,200 for a house that rented for $300. 1%. Of course, I didn't know that rule of thumb back then, but that worked.
1970. So okay, that was before real estate really did much. So you enjoyed the next 10 years for sure.
I did. So as we know, and by today's metrics that we all follow and use, that was a magic formula. So people say, oh my gosh, I wish I could go back to the 90s, you know, in the high-end cities in California where I could have cash flow. No, you really got to go back to, you know, places like Silicon Valley and coastal cities along the state. You got to go back to the early 70s to really have bought properties that have that magic 1% number. So it's, so that house today is worth $1 million, which is the median price in Silicon Valley. And it rents for, you know, the headlines squawk about how expensive it is at $3,500. Well, it's rent to price ratio has dropped by 3x. So after 30 years in high tech, having bought a bunch of houses in the 70s, I realized one day that I was earning my rental properties that I had bought were earning me more while I was sleeping than my day job was with my stock options. So that's when I decided to switch in 2000 to full-time real estate investing. And boy, was that a good decision.
So that was in 2000. Yeah. So the next 5 years mm-hmm. was a lot of fun too.
It sure was. Yeah. A lot of fun. Now, of course, I learned at that point in time, because the rent ratio had declined so much that I needed to go somewhere else. So you and I both did that and went and found other cities that still had strong economics, but the house prices had not appreciated as much. And of course, if they haven't appreciated as much in the house prices, then the rents don't fall behind as much in rent ratio. So, you know, Texas and Dallas is the place I happened to pick, and it turned out to be a good decision that worked out well for us.
Now, you had invested in other states as well. Was that before Texas or after?
After. So the other states, other than a couple, I mean, I'd done a couple flips in Florida and had some property in Virginia, Delaware, where I was originally from. But for the most part, what happened was it became tougher and tougher here in the last several years to find houses for our investors with enough margin in it that, you know, they could still work. And I know my whole career in high tech, I've been fortunate enough to be associated with very high quality product. So it's kind of difficult for me to say, well, I guess I'll just go buy, you know, class C and D properties now and class C metros and see if I keep the business going. It just goes against my grain. I just always preferred quality. So that's when we shifted our model for our business back to syndicating multifam and commercial properties. And other people have discovered these hot areas like Dallas and Texas as well. So the demand to supply ratio is increased enough that it's even difficult to find good products in a lot of the cities that we've been investing in the past, like Dallas. So to get more deal flow and to provide our clients with diversity of markets as well as asset classes, that's when we've started going to other states as well, such as North and South Carolina and Oklahoma and places like that.
What are some of the biggest challenges that you've had in investing out of state?
Well, I think finding a team. The old adage before prices went soaring up in the country over the last several decades, most of the gurus were recommending, you know, always buy where you can go down the street and find the product. And if the numbers work, that's okay. Except I differ with that approach a little bit, because it tends to, I think it's always good to learn a little bit about what your other folks that you hire and delegate to, what they really have to do. So getting some skin in the game and paying your due diligence is okay to, say, manage some of your own rental properties to start with. But it certainly, I think, impedes your growth if you try to play landlord as well as investor. So I really believe, fortunately, I learned early on in my career the power of delegating and surrounding yourself with experts who know more about things, different aspects of what you're doing than you do. So I've used that model well in high tech, and I've used it in real estate investing. So I think when you're in another area, the biggest challenge is that you've got to go assemble a team, or you got to go find say, a turnkey provider or syndicator who's doing all that work for you. I tell people, even, you know, when I go at another market, another asset class, even though I've had a lot of experience and a lot of volume of product, if it includes an asset class, let's say single tenant industrial, and I've been doing hundreds of houses, and so I know something about one aspect of real estate, but not that. I make sure I've got somebody on the team who's an expert in that area, and I make sure I've got somebody on the team who's an expert in the in that market that we're in. So I think for those who are looking for other markets, you know, it's a real challenge to put together a team. And I really, really recommend that, you know, you go find others who've already done the heavy lifting.
How have you found the cycles in comparison to California? And we're talking just residential right at the moment. So residential cycles in California versus, say, Texas.
I'd say they've been fairly similar, you know, through my own experience and certainly through the great education that I've also attained from listening to you over the years. When people say, how's the market? My first response is, well, first of all, the market is thousands of submarkets. And whether it's a different asset class or it's a different city, they all are somewhat out of phase. I'd say Texas has been pretty much in phase with California. As a generalization, although generally, as we know, not as severe, both on the upside and on the downside. It's very good to have, I think, somebody in your camp who studies these cycles well. And if you're in houses in California, certainly your listeners have learned that you provided very valuable input to them up in the commercial arena. In that larger scale, you know, it's easier to get data. You have to pay for it, but because REITs and institutional investors are into that space, and of course, it wasn't until you know, this past several years that that institutions considered houses an asset class. But we, for example, in watching these cycles in Dallas, I sold a $10 million apartment complex about 4 years ago for cap rate of 6. And exchanged it into commercial and office and industrial products that were cap rates of 8 and 9. So you can always pull money out of some asset class or some field that's maybe finished its expansion and go find someplace else that you can invest that money in that's still expanding. So that technique, you know, certainly works well. And I think people sometimes forget that different price classes can vary quite a bit. For example, in California, of course, in the early 2000s, most people think, well, everything went up. Well, in Silicon Valley, where higher-end homes also exist, and those are mostly bought by you know, stock option money, the upper-end houses, higher-end ones, actually went down during that time period because of the dot-com crash and all of those that were using stock options from IPOs and so forth before that couldn't afford it. So here you had the median price going up and you had higher end houses, say in the 2, 3, 4 million, drop 25%. So you got to be careful in which price class you're in too, not just the market.
As a real estate investor, do you feel like you've mostly been self-taught or do you have some favorite mentors that have helped?
I would say that it's certainly both. I think everybody needs to figure out from themselves how they learn best. And some learn best by attending class, others by reading books, others hands-on, and so forth. Of course, the problem with hands-on is it can take a long time to get all the experiences that somebody else had. So I would say for me, the way that I've learned the most is from finding people who are more knowledgeable than I am in in the particular subject or topic that I'm learning and ask them a lot of questions. And so I find that's a very efficient way. You know, if you read a book that they wrote, you may get a lot of that, but it's not as efficient. If I find somebody who's gracious enough to, you know, spend some time with me and answer my specific questions, then it's kind of a shortcut to get to the things, to fill in the holes of the things I don't know. So I would say for me, you know, in parallel with my experiences, it's been asking others who are more experienced and smarter than I am my questions. I'm always amazed at how much information you can get by asking. Most people, I think, once they've acquired information, you know, some are protective of it if they feel it's you know, extremely valuable IP to their niche business. But I think for the most part, most people really enjoy, they like to share. They like to share with others what they've learned. They like to help other people not make the same mistakes they did and so forth. So I think most people are very, very generous in sharing their information. Would you agree?
Yeah, I actually have been impressed with your persistence. You definitely get people to say stuff. You're kind of a... You're kind of dogged in that pursuit, but you do get what you came for. So I think that's one of probably your best qualities, is you're just persistent.
Thank you. And I also find if you ask the same question, right, two or three different ways, sometimes it helps you get to where you're going. Maybe the first question doesn't really quite get what you're trying to find out.
Yeah, my best friend Alex, it closes like that. Somebody says no to one thing. He says, in essence, basically, you know, I must have misstated my position. And he restates it until he gets the yes answer and the people finally default. So I guess we better give in to this guy.
I don't give up easily. Whether it's trying to reach a goal or get an answer to something that I just passionate about wanting to understand.
Has the way that you find deals, how has that evolved during this career that you've had? Say from 2000 on, especially.
Yep. I've relied largely on the delegating and leveraging others approach that I was taught, fortunately, in the high tech industry. And, you know, that's really tough for a techie to do. Most techies are trained academically, and maybe they, you know, genetically are inclined to go figure things out from themselves. And fortunately, I had a good mentor early on that said, Tom, you can get a lot more done if you go utilize the knowledge and leverage other people. So, during my years of providing turnkey rental houses to others, and now in recent years providing multifam and commercial properties, I've relied almost entirely on the technique of getting partners who provide the deal flow. So I find others that I co-syndicate with from a management standpoint and sponsor standpoint, who have built up over many years, often decades, relationships with others that know that they their integrity and that trust them and that know that they're closers, and let them use those relationships and expertise to go find product. And then they bring the product to me, they filter it, and then they bring the product to me, and then we further filter it. And then, you know, one out of every few hundred deals that come across everybody's desk filters down to being good enough, and we co-sponsor it. So I'd much rather, and that's what we did in houses. We had rather than doing our own mailing campaign and hiring our own bird doggers and all that sort of thing, I've always said, well, let's go tap on others who are already doing that, already developed the expertise, already got systems in place, and let's let them bring us the houses, and I'm fine to pay them a fee. Some people said, Tom, why have you got your real estate license so you can save all that money? And I'm like, well, it doesn't make any difference if I have it or not. These people are providing a service, and they deserve to be rewarded and paid for their time. So I've always used others to bring deals. Now, having been exposed in the business for this length of time, sure, I get deals that are brought to me. But what do I do with them? That's not the area that I want to focus my time, where I think I can contribute the most. So I immediately hand that off to one of my sponsors and say, hey, here's a deal. Take a look at it. If you think it works, let's do it together. So I'd much rather take a smaller piece of the pie and have more experts and more resources to get a deal done.
Have you ever had so much on your plate that looking back, you go, okay, I need not to do that again?
Surely. I think one measure of success to me is when you have enough deals that you can afford to say no. And I certainly at times in the past, I've tried to get too many deals going at once. And I've always been one, and I don't know how this shakes out for the average person, but I've always been one who can do a few things exceedingly well. But when I get up to some kind of critical mass point of the number of things on my desk or table, opportunities at a time, I don't do any of them well. So that's one thing I always recommend to others. Don't get too much on your plate. We've had, I've had folks come to me and say, Tom, a couple of years ago, you were enough to sit down with me and chat about, my approach and where to invest and how to invest. And I'm proud to tell you that I've bought 12 houses. And I say, wow, that's just fantastic. Where did you buy them? I say, well, I got one in Orlando, and I got one in Raleigh, and I got one in Oklahoma City, and I got two in Dallas.
Uh-huh. Wow.
they're in nine different places. And I say, oh my gosh, that's, don't you find that difficult to manage? You got to talk to nine different property managers. So in a small way, I guess that's an example of how people can get in trouble. It's always good to have more than one source of something, but you got to be careful. I just had a very good friend of mine. His name is Jay Baker, and his wife is my wife's best friend from high school, and he became very successful by doing a leveraged buyout of Kohl's when they had 30 stores and took it to 800 stores. So he has a B behind his net worth, and he's had a lot of success. That when I get together, most of our time is spent as friends, but I also can you believe this, Bruce? I ask him some questions. And I said, Jay, what's your thought about, sources for business? You were in the merchandising and retail business, and you had to have multiple sources of products that you put in the stores. And he said, I think most people make the mistake of trying to develop too many different resources or sources for the same item. And I feel it's much better to, yes, you want more than one, but I feel it's much better to restrict it to mostly two or three and develop really deep relationships with them. And I thought that was a good takeaway.
Yeah, I think that's true. We got 54 seconds left. So what are some top recommendations to new investors?
Don't try to do it all yourself. Tap on others that have the experience. Sometimes it feels like, oh gosh, I think I can do it myself and save a few bucks. But in the end, there's a high cost of learning. And I think it's very important to tap on others. I think it's very important to recognize how different submarkets can vary from the averages. It's easier to get data from the averages, but the submarkets can vary a lot. And once you get into that level of detail, you really need to tap on somebody else that knows that market very well. And I'll end on a positive, on a humorous note. I think great principles are also not complicated as much as people think. For example, Conrad Hilton, the first one that built a big hotel empire, was asked one time what was the most valuable thing that he learned. And he said to leave the shower curtain inside the tub.
With that, Tom, thank you for joining us. And Tom will pick it up in our next segment.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.